Part 2, Chapter 25. Don't do that, Scout. Set him out on the back steps. Jim, are you crazy? I said, set him out on the back steps. Sighing, I scooped up the small creature, placed him on the bottom step, and went back to my cot. September had come, but not a trace of cool weather with it, and we were still sleeping on the back screen porch. Lightning bugs were still about. The night crawlers and flying insects that beat against the screen in the summer long had not gone, wherever they chose to go when autumn comes. A roly-poly had found his way inside the house. I reasoned that the tiny varmint had crawled up the steps and under the door. I was putting my book on the floor beside my cot when I saw him. The creatures are no more than an inch long, and when you touch them, they roll themselves into a tight gray ball. I lay on my stomach, reached down, and poked him. He rolled up, then, feeling safe, I suppose, he slowly unrolled. He traveled a few inches on his 100 legs, and I touched him again. He rolled up. Feeling sleepy, I decided to end things. My hand was going down on him when Jim spoke. Jim was scowling. It was probably a part of the stage he was going through, and I wished he would hurry up and get through it. He was certainly never cruel to animals, but I had never known his charity to embrace the insect world. "Why couldn't I mash him?" I asked. "Because they don't bother you," Jim answered in the darkness. He had turned out his reading light. "Reckon you're at the stage now where you don't kill flies and mosquitoes now, I reckon. Let me know when you change your mind. Tell you one thing, though, I ain't going to sit around and not scratch a red bug." "Aw, dry up," he answered drowsily. Jim was the one who was getting more like a girl every day, not I. Comfortable, I lay on my back and waited for sleep, and while waiting, I thought of Dill. He had left us the first of the month with firm assurances that he would return the minute school was out. He guessed his folks had got the general idea that he liked to spend his summers in Macomb. Miss Rachel took us with them in the taxi to Macomb Junction, and Dill waved to us from the train window until he was out of sight. He was not out of mind. I missed him. The last 2 days of his time with us, Jim had taught him to swim. I was wide awake, remembering what Dill had told me. Baker's Eddy is at the end of a dirt road off the Meridian Highway, about a mile from town. It's easy to catch a ride down the highway on a cotton wagon or from a passing motorist, and the short walk to the creek is easy. But the prospect of walking all the way back home at dusk when the traffic is light is tiresome, and swimmers are careful not to stay too late. According to Dill, he and Jim had just come to the highway when they saw Atticus driving toward them. He looked like he had not seen them, so they both waved. Atticus finally slowed down. When they caught up with him, he said, "You better catch a ride back. I won't be going home for a while." Calpurnia was in the back seat. Jim protested, then pleaded, and Atticus said, "All right, you can come with us if you stay in the car." On the way to Tom Robinson's, Atticus told them what had happened. They turned off the highway, rode slowly by the dump, and past the Ewell residence, down the narrow lane to the Negro cabins. Dill said a crowd of black children were playing marbles in Tom's front yard. Atticus parked the car and got out. Calpurnia followed him through the front gate. Dill heard him ask one of the children, "Where's your mother, Sam?" and heard Sam say, "She's down at Sis Stevens, Mr. Finch. Want me to run fetch her?" Dill said Atticus looked uncertain, then he said yes, and Sam scampered off. "Go on with your game, boys," Atticus said to the children. A little girl came to the cabin door and stood looking at Atticus. Dill said her hair was a wad of tiny, stiff pigtails, each ending in a bright bow. She grinned from ear to ear and walked toward our father, but she was too small to navigate the steps. Dill said Atticus went to her, took off his hat, and offered her his finger. She grabbed it, and he eased her down the steps, then he gave her to Calpurnia. Sam was trotting behind his mother when they came up. Helen said, "Evening, Mr. Finch, won't you have a seat?" But she didn't say any more. Neither did Atticus. "Scout," said Dill, "she just fell down in the dirt, like a giant with a big foot, just come along and stepped on her, just ump." Dill's fat foot hit the ground, like you'd step on an ant. Dill said Calpurnia and Atticus lifted Helen to her feet and half carried, half walked her to the cabin. They stayed inside a long time and Atticus came out alone. When they drove back by the dump, some of the Ewells hollered at them, but Dill didn't catch what they'd said. Macomb was interested by the news of Tom's death for perhaps 2 days. 2 days was enough for the information to spread through the county. "Did you hear about? No? Well, they say he was running fit to beat lightning." To Macomb, Tom's death was typical. Typical of a nigger to cut and run. Typical of a nigger's mentality to have no plan, no thought for the future. Just run blind, first chance he saw. Funny thing, Atticus Finch might have got him off scot-free, but wait, hell no, you know how they are, easy come, easy go. Just shows you that Robinson boy was legally married. They say he kept himself clean, went to church and all that, but when it comes down to the line, the veneer's mighty thin. Nigger always comes out in him. A few more details, enabling the listener to repeat his version in turn, then nothing about until the Macomb Tribune appeared the following Thursday. There was a brief obituary in the colored news, but there was also an editorial. Mr. B.B. Underwood, Underwood was at his most bitter, and he couldn't have cared less who canceled advertising and subscriptions. But Macomb didn't play that way. Mr. Underwood could holler till he sweated and write whatever he wanted to. He'd still get his advertising and his subscriptions. If he wanted to make a fool of himself and his paper, that was his business. Mr. Underwood didn't talk about miscarriages of justice. He was writing so children could understand. Mr. Underwood simply figured it was a sin to kill cripples, be they standing, sitting, or escaping. He likened Tom's death to the senseless slaughter of songbirds by hunters and children, and Macomb thought he was trying to write an editorial poetical enough to be reprinted in the Montgomery Advertiser. How could this be so, I wondered as I read Mr. Underwood's editorial. Senseless killing. Tom had been given due process of law to the day of his death. He had been tried openly and convicted by 12 good men, and true, my father had fought for him all the way. Then, Mr. Underwood's meaning became clear. Atticus had used every tool available to free men to save Tom Robinson, but in the secret courts of men's hearts, Atticus had no case. Tom was a dead man the minute Mayella Ewell opened her mouth and screamed. The name Ewell gave me a queasy feeling. Macomb had lost no time in getting Mr. Ewell's views on Tom's demise and passing them along through the English channel of gossip. Miss Stephanie Crawford, Miss Stephanie told Aunt Alexandra in Jim's presence, "Oh, foot, he's old enough to listen," that Mr. Ewell said it made one down and about two more to go. Jim told me not to be afraid. Mr. Ewell was more hot gas than anything. Jim also told me that if I breathed a word to Atticus, if in any way I let Atticus know I knew, Jim would personally never speak to me again. Chapter 26. School started, and so did our daily trips past the Radley place. Jim was in the 7th grade and went to high school, beyond the grammar school building. I was now in the 3rd grade, and our routines were so different I only walked to school with Jim in the mornings and saw him at mealtimes. He went out for football, but was too slender and too young yet to do anything but carry the team water buckets. This he did with enthusiasm. Most afternoons he was seldom home before dark. The Radley place had ceased to terrify me, but it was no less gloomy, no less chilly under its great oaks, and no less uninviting. Mr. Nathan Radley could still be seen on a clear day walking to and from town. We knew Boo was there for the same old reason. Nobody had seen him carried out yet. I sometimes felt a twinge of remorse when passing by the old place at ever having taken part in what must have been sheer torment to Arthur Radley. What reasonable recluse wants children peeping through his shutters, delivering greetings on the end of a fishing pole, wandering in his collards at night? And yet I remembered 2 Indian head pennies, chewing gum, soap dolls, a rusty medal, a broken watch, and chain. Jim must have put them away somewhere. I stopped and looked at the tree one afternoon. The trunk was swelling around its cement patch. The patch itself was turning yellow. We had almost seen him a couple of times, a good enough score for anybody. But I still looked for him each time I went by. Maybe someday we would see him. I imagined how it would be when it happened. He'd just be sitting in the swing when I came along. "Howdy-do, Mr. Arthur," I would say, as if I had said it every afternoon of my life. "Evening, Jean Louise," he would say, as if he had said it every afternoon of my life. "Pretty right spell we're having, isn't it?" "Yes, sir, right pretty," I would say, and go on. It was only a fantasy. We would never see him. He probably did go out when the moon was down and gaze upon Miss Stephanie Crawford. I'd have picked somebody else to look at, but that was his business. He would never gaze at us. "You aren't starting that again, are you?" said Atticus one night when I expressed a stray desire just to have one good look at Boo Radley before I died. "If you are, I'll tell you right now, stop it. I'm too old to go chasing you off the Radley property. Besides, it's dangerous. You might get shot. You know Mr. Nathan shoots at every shadow he sees, even shadows that leave size 4 bare footprints. You were lucky not to be killed." I hushed then and there. At the same time, I marveled at Atticus. This was the first time he had let us know he knew a lot more about something than we thought he knew. And it had happened years ago. No, only last summer. No, summer before last. When? Time was playing tricks on me. I must remember to ask Jim. So many things had happened to us. Boo Radley was the least of our fears. Atticus said he didn't see how anything else could happen, that things had a way of settling down, and after enough time had passed, people would forget that Tom Robinson's existence was ever brought to their attention. Perhaps Atticus was right, but the events of the summer hung over us like a smoke in a closed room. The adults in Macomb never discussed the case with Jim and me. It seemed that they discussed it with their children, and their attitude must have been that neither of us could have helped having Atticus for a parent, so their children must be nice to us in spite of him. The children would never have thought that up for themselves. Had our classmates been left to their own devices, Jim and I would have had several swift, satisfying fistfights apiece and ended the matter for good. As it was, we were compelled to hold our heads high and be, respectively, a gentleman and a lady. In a way, it was like the era of Mrs. Henry LaFay DuBose, without all her yelling. There was one odd thing, though, and that I never understood. In spite of Atticus's shortcomings as a parent, people were content to re-elect him to the state legislature that year, as usual, without opposition. I came to the conclusion that people were just peculiar. I withdrew from them and never thought about them until I was forced to. I was forced to one day in school. Once a week, we had a current events period. Each child was supposed to clip an item from a newspaper, absorb its contents, and reveal them to the class. This practice allegedly overcame a variety of evils. Standing in front of his fellows encouraged good posture and gave a child poise. Delivering a short talk made him word conscious. Learning his current events strengthened his memory. Being singled out made him more than ever anxious to return to the group. The idea was profound, but as usual in Maycomb, it didn't work very well. In the first place, few rural children had access to newspapers, so the burden of current events was borne by the town children, convincing the bus children more deeply that the town children got all the attention anyway. The rural children who could usually brought clippings from what they called the grit paper, a publication spurious in the eyes of Miss Gates, our teacher. Why she frowned when a child recited from the grit paper, I never knew, but in some way it was associated with liking fiddling, eating syrupy biscuits for lunch, being a holy roller, singing Sweetly Sings the Donkey, and pronouncing it donkey, all of which the state paid teachers to discourage. Even so, not many children knew what a current event was. Little Chuck Little, 100 years old in his knowledge of cows and their habits, was halfway through an Uncle Natural story when Miss Gates stopped him. "Charles, that is not a current event. That is an advertisement." Cecil Jacobs knew what one was, though. When his turn came, he went to the front of the room and began. "Old Hitler." "Adolf Hitler, Cecil," said Miss Gates. "One never begins with old anybody." "Yes, ma'am," he said. "Old Adolf Hitler has been prosecuting the..." "Persecuting, Cecil." "No, Miss Gates, it says here..." "Well, anyway, old Adolf Hitler has been after the Jews, and he's putting them in prisons and taking away all their property, and he won't let any of them out of the country, and he's washing all the feeble-minded and..."
"Washing the feeble-minded?"
"Yes, ma'am, Miss Gates. I reckon they don't have sense enough to wash themselves. I don't reckon an idiot could keep himself clean. Well, anyway, Hitler started a program to round up all the half-Jews, too, and he wants to register them in case they might want to cause him any trouble. And I think it's a bad thing that... And that's my current event."
"Very good, Cecil," said Miss Gates.
Puffing, Cecil returned to his seat. A hand went up in the back of the room. "How can he do that?"
"Who do what?" asked Miss Gates patiently.
"I mean, how can Hitler just put a lot of folks in a pen like that? Looks like the government has stopped him," said the owner of the hand.
"Hitler is the government," said Miss Gates. And seizing an opportunity to make education dynamic, she went to the blackboard. She printed democracy in large letters.
"Democracy," she said. "Does anybody have a definition?"
"Us," somebody said.
I raised my hand, remembering an old campaign slogan Atticus had once told me about.
"What do you think it means, Jean Louise?"
"Equal rights for all, special privileges for none," I quoted.
"Very good, Jean Louise, very good," Miss Gates smiled. In front of democracy, she printed, "We are a..."
"Now, class, say it all together. We are a democracy."
We said it, then Miss Gates said, "That's the difference between America and Germany. We are a democracy and Germany is a dictatorship."
"Dictatorship," she said. "Over here, we don't believe in persecuting anybody. Persecution comes from people who are prejudiced."
"Prejudice," she enunciated carefully.
"There are no better people in the world than the Jews, and why Hitler doesn't think so is a mystery to me."
An inquiring soul in the middle of the room said, "Why don't they like Jews, you reckon, Miss Gates?"
"I don't know, Henry. They contribute to every society they live in, and most of all, they are a deeply religious people. Hitler's trying to do away with religion, so maybe he doesn't like them for that reason."
Cecil spoke up.
"Well, I don't know for certain," he said. "They're supposed to change money or something, but that ain't no cause to persecute them. They're white, ain't they?"
Miss Gates said, "When you get to high school, Cecil, you'll learn that the Jews had been persecuted since the beginning of history, even driven out of their own country. It's one of the most terrible stories in history. Time for arithmetic, children."
As I had never liked arithmetic, I spent the period looking out the window. The only time I ever saw Atticus scowl was when Elmer Davis would give us the latest on Hitler. Atticus would snap off the radio and say, "Humph." I asked him once why he was impatient with Hitler, and Atticus said, "Because he's a maniac." "This would not do," I mused as the class proceeded with its sums. "One maniac and millions of German folks looked to me like they shut Hitler in a pen instead of letting him shut them up. There was something else wrong. I would ask my father about it."
I did, and he said he could not possibly answer my question because he didn't know the answer.
"But it's okay to hate Hitler?"
"It is not," he said. "It is not okay to hate anybody."
"Atticus," I said, "there's something I don't understand. Miss Gates said it was awful, Hitler doing like he does. She got real red in the face about it."
"I should think she would."
"But..."
"Yes?"
"Nothing, sir." I went away, not sure that I
could explain to Atticus what was on my mind. Not sure that I could clarify what was only a feeling. Perhaps Jim could provide the answer. Jim understood school things better than Atticus. Jim was worn out from a day's water carrying. There were at least 12 banana peels on the floor by his bed, surrounding an empty milk bottle. "What you stuffing for?" I asked. "Coach says if I can gain 25 pounds by next year, year after next, I can play," he said. "This is the quickest way." "If you don't throw it all up, Jim," I said, "I want to ask you something." "Shoot," he said. He put down his book and stretched his legs. "Miss Gates is a nice lady, ain't she?" "Why, sure," said Jim. "I liked her when I was in her room." "She hates Hitler a lot." "What's wrong with that?" "Well, she went on today about how bad it was him treating the Jews like that. Jim, it's not right to prosecute anybody, is it? I mean, have mean thoughts about anybody, even, is it?" "Gracious no, Scout. What's eating you?" "Well, coming out of the courthouse that night, Miss Gates was... she was going down the steps in front of us. You must have not seen her. She was talking with Miss Stephanie Crawford. I heard her say it's time somebody taught them a lesson. They were getting way above themselves, and the next thing they think they can do is marry us. Jim, how can you hate Hitler so bad and then turn around and be ugly about folks right at home?" Jim was suddenly furious. He leaped off the bed, grabbed me by the collar, and shook me. "I never want to hear about that courthouse again. Ever, ever. You hear me? You hear me? Don't you ever say one word to me about it again. You hear? Now go on." I was too surprised to cry. I crept from Jim's room and shut the door softly, lest undue noise set him off again. Suddenly tired, I wanted Atticus. He was in the living room, and I went to him and tried to get in his lap. Atticus smiled. "You're getting so big now, I'll just have to hold a part of you." He held me close. "Scout," he said softly, "don't let Jim get you down. He's having a rough time these days. I heard you back there." Atticus said that Jim was trying hard to forget something, but that what he was really doing was storing it away for a while until enough time passed. Then he would be able to think about it and sort things out. When he was able to think about it, Jim would be himself again. Thanks for listening to this chapter. Be sure to hit that red subscribe button down below or click on my picture just up above to subscribe to my channel so that I can make more of these audiobooks.